From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
I'm John Wells.
This morning, we speak with National Geographic Explorer, TED Talker, and award-winning documentarian Lucy Cook, who explores a fierce, funny, and revolutionary look at the queens of the animal kingdom in her new book, Bitch, on the Female of the Species.
Then senior editor at Scientific American magazine, Tanya Lewis, rejoins us to discuss the rollout of the newest age group approved for the COVID vaccine and other updates on the science behind COVID.
These two guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Now, as Charles Darwin and the generations of scientists that followed would have it, males are the drivers of evolution, competitive and dominant. Females, on the other hand, submissive, passive, and a side note in the evolutionary story. The stereotypes of female passivity and male vigor have pervaded scientific study in our imaginations ever since. The only problem, says my guest, Lucy Cook, is that it's simply not true. Lucy is a National Geographic Explorer, a TED Talker, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and holds a master's degree in zoology. She joins me to discuss her new book, and here's the title for you, Bitch, on the Female of the Species. Lucy Cook, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's a total pleasure to be here.
Well, I have to know, why did you want to rewrite the science of evolution and sex? Were there just too many absolutes for a non-absolute topic or a non-binary definition of biology and gender?
Yeah, I think there are. And as I was taught at university, many moons ago now, the biological sex, which is defined by your gonads, whether you produce eggs or sperm, that had very rigid deterministic traits that followed through from whether you were an egg maker or whether you were a sperm maker. If you were a sperm maker, then the world was your oyster and you were the dominant driver of evolution, as you say. But us egg makers, we were second fiddle to the sperm shooters. I was taught that by Richard Dawkins way back and when I was studying at Oxford, and it always bothered me. I'll be honest, it wasn't great news for an 18-year-old egg-making student of evolution to discover basically that she's a loser. So it's taken me a while to get around to challenging these assumptions, but now I have. Now I've got a whole book full of challenges to these assumptions.
And all of the stories in your book about all of these different animals, I'm wondering where it was that you first in your studies thought, wait a minute, there's a flag going up here for me. This is not this evolutionary biology that we sort of adhere to. It's not adding up.
Yeah, it was, funny enough, it was about 10 or 15 years ago, and I'd gone on to be a documentary maker, and I hadn't thought much about the subject of sexual evolution over the years, but I was in the Maasai Mara presenting a series for the BBC about communication, animal communication, and I was trying to have a conversation with a lion by doing playback experiment. So we had the sound of a lion's roar and we were playing it in another lion's territory, which is an audacious line of scientific inquiry at the best of times. So we did this experiment, and sure enough, we attracted another male lion came to check us out. But he had a female with him, right? And the male lion just disappeared when there wasn't something that looked like another lion to attack. The female, on the other hand, pinned us to the spot for like 2 hours. We were trapped there. But she was lying in front of us, her legs wide open. She looked like she was saying, hey, guys, come and get me. And I said to my the specialist that I was with, I was like, so what's going on, you know? And he goes, oh, he was German, by the way. And he goes, oh, she wants to meet with us. And I was like, but she's with that other lion, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, but a female lioness, she is mating many, many hundreds of times when she's an estrus with multiple males, you know? And I was just like, whoa, this wasn't what I was taught at university. You know, what's going on here? That was the first inkling that I had that the things that I'd been taught were wrong in actual fact. And really, since I was at university, there has been a revolution in our understanding of what it means to be female. And that's what I document in the book.
So does it mean, when you're female, does it mean that you are monogamous, for example? And tell us those cases in which birds, for example, possibly socially monogamous, but...
Yeah, so it turns out there's a big difference between social and sexual monogamy in the animal kingdom. And loads of animals that are socially monogamous, like songbirds, turns out sexually monogamous, not so much, you know. So this was actually discovered by an amazing scientist called Patricia Goarty back in the 1980s, and she did DNA fingerprinting on a clutches of eggs and found out that songbirds, you know, a clutch of eggs had multiple fathers generally. And this, you know, completely rocked the ornithological establishment because, you know, songbirds appear to be the very paragons of monogamy. You know, you see the male and he sings his heart out and female chooses her partner and then diligently together they'll build a nest and raise the chicks and, you know, often within sight of a human home, you know, so of a human family. You know, so we really sort of have imposed our values onto these creatures and actually... You know, they're not monogamous. The females are just as sexually strategic as the males, and that strategy often involves mating with multiple males because for the simple reason, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. You know, the more males that you mate with, the greater chance you have of finding genetic compatibility.
Right, and brood that survives because it's got a strong line of genetics, because maybe the one guy that you chose didn't have strength in his genes.
Exactly. I mean, that's, you know, that basically that one of the things that Darwin assumed, which we now understand to be wrong, is that the sort of competition over sex, you know, the competition between males would end at mating. But it doesn't end at mating. I mean, you know, females will mate multiply and then the sperm will basically compete inside of the female. And you know what I found out, which just blew my mind? This sort of whole idea of a sperm race, right? And you know, whichever sperm wins, you know, is the sort of heroic gamete that wins the prize of reaching there first. Well, it turns out that there was a study very recently on human fertilization, in fact, and it isn't the first sperm that wins, it's the egg that chooses in the end which sperm actually fertilizes. So this whole idea of a sperm race is completely not true. But nevertheless, by mating with multiple males and having lots of different sperm, you know, the egg is able to choose the one that's the best genetic match.
So the egg chooses the genetic match. This is very dominant. Another female, let's talk about the adorable little meerkat and the ruthless, dominant female that she is.
Yeah. So, you know, the other sort of another great myth is that females are not competitive. You know, that the idea was that we were all basically the same. We're all good mothers, you know, strong maternal instinct, but as such, all the same, and therefore not worth studying. And by all being the same, that also means that we're basically not invited to the evolutionary party on account of being too boring. But low variance basically means, you know, that you don't really evolve. You know, so it's a ludicrous assumption when you say it out loud, but that's what's been the belief for a very long time. Now, the meerkat throws that all on its head because the female meerkat is a wildly competitive creature, as many mammals are, many female mammals are, but she's particularly brutal. So brutal, in fact, that there was a survey recently of 1,000 mammals trying to find out which was the most murderous amongst them, which animal was most likely to be killed by a member of its own kind. The number one on that list, beating even humans, was the meerkat. And if you're a meerkat, you're most likely to be killed by another female meerkat, probably your own mother or your sister, right? So basically, meerkat society is predicated on this ruthless competition where there's a dominant female and she wants to prevent all the others from breeding so she can monopolize all the resources and co-opt the others into helping her pump out yet more babies and be much more reproductively successful. In order to achieve this, she will basically bully the other females so that they don't reproduce. But if they dare to, then she'll kill their babies and evict them from the group, which is tantamount to death sentence in the Kalahari. And then they're allowed back on the condition they'll wet nurse her babies so all of her energy can go into more pregnancies rather than the effort of lactation, right? Now, as such, you know, the females, you know, are hugely productive. They have many more litters a year than an animal would be expected of an animal their size, and so there's a huge variance in the success of, you know, if you're the dominant female versus the sister that never gets to mate. You know, there's a huge amount of difference there, and that difference drives evolution. So, you know, the idea that females are not competitive or as varied as males is just bunkum.
If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation on the female of the species with zoologist Lucy Cook. Her book is called Bitch, which is a great title, by the way. How did you come to decide on that title? Was that with the help of your editor, or was that you just knew it needed to be called this?
Oh, it's a really good question, actually. I've got a friend of mine who's a really brilliant investigative journalist who's... I was telling her about the subject of my book, and she just, you know, with that great journalism head on her, she turned around and she went, "You know, you want to call that bitch." I was like, "You're absolutely right, Carol. That's what I need to call it." You know, because I'm keen to reclaim this, you know, human females get cast with a whole load of derogatory words for behaviors that would be acceptable if we were males. So, you know, as I show in my book, most of the females who are either promiscuous or aggressive or, you know, might be called unpleasant names are actually just being assiduously maternal. They're being good mothers. So, you know, I'm reclaiming the word bitch as it shouldn't be a swear word. It's a word for a female dog. It shouldn't be a swear word.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about, you know, I guess my question is, why have females been so stereotyped, and males, throughout science? I mean, science is an inquiry that the most curious minds ought to want to get to the bottom of these things. Is there some social reason? Does it explain world order if we don't bring in the strength, the relative strength of the female animal? Then perhaps it has a trickle-down effect onto a human species. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? You know, why is this happened? And I don't have the answer to that because I'm not a sociologist, right? I'm a zoologist. But what I have done is I've charted and documented how these stereotypes have become embedded in scientific culture, you know. And funny enough, I found it goes all the way back to Aristotle, actually, who's the grandfather of zoology. And, you know, he said that, you know, basically because eggs were sedentary and sperm were mobile, he felt that females were passive and males were active, you know. So that was Aristotle at the dawn of zoology. And then Darwin, who would have no doubt have read Aristotle, he came to the same conclusion. But he had a hunch it was down to the same sort of thing, that, you know, these energy expensive, immobile, sedentary eggs that we don't produce many of, whereas males produce lots of mobile sperm, that would be somehow that had tipped the balance, and that was the reason why. And then what happened is in the 1940s, Darwin's sexual stereotypes were given an empirical lifeline by a British plant geneticist by the name of Angus Bateman, who performed an experiment on fruit flies, which substantiated Darwin's claims. And then that that experiment was then cited by Robert Trivers in a 1972 paper that went on to become the most cited paper. I think it's been cited over 11,000 times in evolutionary biology. So that's your charting of how these stereotypes became embedded. Now, you know, at every stage, these assumptions have been questioned. And Patricia Goati, who I mentioned earlier, who studies the birds, she was so convinced that, you know, the fundamental nature of Angus Bateman's study, which empirically proved Darwin's stereotypes, she thought, well, you know, we better repeat that experiment, because, you know, that's the essence of science, right? Is that you can replicate experiments and get the same results. Well, she spent 10 years taking a forensic scalpel to Bateman's study. She's even exhumed his original lab notes and gone through his original data. And she finds that the results were skewed in favor of the results that he wanted to find. There was a peculiar way that he parceled the data together so that it gave him this result that he wanted. And it was basically a statistical sleight of hand that underpins the whole thing. But yet, still, Bateman's study is cited endlessly because people are lazy. They just cite the same old, you know what I mean? And then what happens is Goati's papers get accused of being ideologically driven, you know, which is also completely unfair because, you know, Darwin, I don't believe he was essentially, you know, actively sexist, but, you know, his work was based in misogynistic thinking. Do you know what I mean? It was the Victorian era. So, you know, it's taking hard for these paradigms to change.
Busting out of those stereotypes of gender identity and sexual preference brings us to a conversation about, oh, this little male clownfish, does he really change his gender?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things in my investigation that completely blew my mind. And this was one of the ones that I found the most fascinating, right? I mean, I was fully aware of the numerous species that are hermaphroditic, many of which, like these fish are sequential hermaphrodites. So they'll change from being male to female, sometimes as much as several times a day for some fish. I mean, wow. Amazing, really, when you think what biology is capable of. But in the case, the clownfish is probably the most famous because it's the Finding Nemo fish. Everybody knows the clownfish. And in Finding Nemo, of course, little Nemo loses his mum and goes on a big adventure and then is reunited with his dad in the end. Well, a biologically accurate version of Finding Nemo would have seen little Nemo lose his mum and then his father would have changed into his mother and then started having sex with him. So, I mean, would have been a very different film. I think we can't blame Disney for not rolling with that necessarily. But anyway, what's fascinating about these fish is you have dominant female, she's removed, and the male, who was her partner, will change into being the female. And in which case, it enables Justin Rhodes, who studies these fish in Ohio, to look at, you know, that process in detail to see how it works. And he's found that what happens is the fish is, as soon as the female is removed, the male partner almost immediately starts behaving and is recognized as a female fish. But the fascinating thing is that the fish's gonads, its sex organs, take up to a year to catch up, to change from being testes to ovaries. So the biological sex of that fish remains male long before the fish itself is recognized and behaves itself as a female. And what's particularly interesting about this is, you know, relevant for our times, is just, it just goes to show how, I mean, we don't talk about gender in animals because we think of that as being a human construct. But, you know, this is, you know, I'm using gender in inverted commas, the gender of this fish and its biological sex are uncoupled, right? It looks like they are independently regulated. And of course, you know, that just at least in this fish, and it suggests that sex is extremely complicated, and I think it's something that we already know about as humans, but it was very interesting to see in the animal kingdom.
You also talk about how there's this heteronormative bias that's being kind of turned on its head. There are lots, there's a lot of sexual preference, females among females, the albatross and the female bonobos. I never know how to say that. Is it bonobos or bonobos?
I think they're happy with either.
Either, yeah.
So or either. Either or either.
Either, either. Exactly. How about the albatross, the female couples?
Oh, I love this story, man. It was just so fantastic. I went to Hawaii to investigate this story, which it illustrates perfectly how, you know, another form of bias, as you say, heteronormative bias, which has clouded our judgment when observing the animal kingdom. So there's this colony in Hawaii of Laysan albatross, and they've been studied for about 50 years, really sort of carefully documented how many breeding pairs there are and everything. And one of the things that was noticed is that every year there were a number of nests that had a double clutch. They had two eggs in it, right? And this is completely impossible for a female albatross to lay two eggs because it's a huge expense and they're just not capable of it. And so all sorts of wild excuses were given for these two eggs. And then eventually, a few years ago, Lindsay Young, who studies the albatross, her and her colleague thought, but has anybody actually checked that they're male and female couples? You know, because the albatross are completely identical. And so they went and did DNA testing on the feathers and found, much to their astonishment, that a third of the bird couples on this colony were female-female couples. And basically the females, there was a shortage of males, and so the females were basically using other albatross husbands as sperm donors and then shacking up with another female to raise the chicks. And these females, these female couples, sometimes they might last just one season, but some of them were incredibly enduring, you know, and there was one couple that I met that had been together for 17 years. They'd had 8 chicks together and 3 grandchicks, and they were amongst the most successful couples on the colony. And Lindsay told me that they do everything the same as the heterosexual couples, all the same lovey-dovey courtship when they're reunited after being on the wing for 6 months and they see one another again. There's all the same preening and, you know, the equivalent of bird kissing to release bird oxytocin that keeps this bond strong, you know. So, you know, and that's a classic example of the sort of the assumptions that trip us up, you know, and how we need to sort of broaden our horizons, really.
Lucy, how has your book been received?
Well, it's been really well received. I have to say, I was waiting for some angry old school backlash, actually, but I haven't had it yet. But who knows? Maybe it's in the post. But I mean, come and get me. You know, I mean, I'm up for debate. You know, I mean, get me on a stage with these sort of, you know, old school evolutionary biologists, and I'll argue the toss. It'll be really fun.
Well, the book is Bitch on the Female of the Species. My guest is Lucy Cook. And Lucy, before I let you go, I have to ask you, I'm so pleased that you did this wonderful and entertaining TED Talk on the sloth. The sloth is just one of my favorite, adorable little animals, but I still don't know, share with us, our listening audience, why the sloth comes down out of the tree to defecate.
Okay, yeah, so one of the greatest mysteries in sloth science is why the sloth will come down to the ground in order to poop, because, you know, it's making itself vulnerable in that moment. You know, it can be taken by an ocelot if it's on the ground, whereas it's safe in the trees. So why do that? Well, of course, the thing that's the biggest drive in any animal is sex, you know. So the reason we think why the sloth comes down to the ground is that it's basically, it's using those latrines to leave love messages. Now, that doesn't sound very romantic to humans, but there are a lot of animals that will use latrine-based love as a way of communicating, you know. So basically the idea is that, you know, you have a sloth that the female's in season, she comes to the ground, she poops at the bottom of the tree she's in. So the males, when they're in season, the females do this extraordinary thing. They scream for sex in D sharp. They go, And that sound carries across the canopy for miles, you know. And then the male sloths, and I've seen this, and it is as funny as you can imagine. They make this really slow, make their way towards the female slowly. But of course, they have to come to the ground, you know, to get between trees. And if they, obviously, they hit the tree with her pheromones at the bottom, they're going to know, bingo, she's up this one, you know. So that's what we think that's all about.
Oh, that sounds like a great explanation. Okay. Well, Lucy Cook, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I love your book. It's such important work and such important science. And I can't believe it's taken this long to get here.
I can't either. you know, it's astonishing to me, but it's fantastic to be on your show. It's a real pleasure. So thank you so much for having me.
Again, that was Lucy Cook, and that was a pre-taped interview I had with her last week. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be speaking with Scientific American's Tanya Lewis about all things COVID and the new age group that is now receiving the COVID vaccine when we return.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. We just listened to a pre-tape conversation that Lynn had with zoologist Lucy Cook. Now, kids under 5 years old have just become the last age group made eligible for a COVID vaccine in the United States. An advisory committee voted unanimously to recommend authorizing the Moderna and Pfizer shots for the youngest children. Joining us to discuss what this means for families and summer plans and the upcoming school year, plus other current COVID science, is senior editor of health and medicine at Scientific American and host of the COVID Quickly podcast, Tanya Lewis. Tanya, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program. And I wanted to start with this. Why did it take so long to get this for little kids?
Yeah, so that's the question on so many parents' minds these days. And the answer is really that, you know, anytime you're testing a new vaccine in children, you know, you really want to make sure that it's safe. So that's one of the main reasons. But another reason is that the COVID, you know, COVID itself is actually most severe in older individuals. So they wanted to test the vaccine in those people first, older adults, and then older children. And then they sort of worked their way down to this youngest age group.
And with the current variations that are out there, variants that are with us, can kids still get really sick with COVID?
Yeah, so they definitely can. Even though the risk to children is lower than it is for older, to adults, for example, there definitely are kids that can get very sick with COVID, and a number of them have died from it. In fact, about more than 500 children under five have died from this disease. So, you know, this is not just a regular cold. This is a little more serious, and children can get a condition called MISC, which stands for multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. And this can cause, you know, inflammation of many different organs, the kidneys, lungs, heart, and so on. And kids can also get long COVID, which is, we know that happens in adults as well.
Tanya, I'm wondering if it's a little bit of an uphill battle now to, you know, really convince parents that getting a vaccine for their child under five is something needed, is something that is a good idea. I think that, you know, knowing that children aren't, COVID doesn't affect them as seriously, even though, like you've just said, there are things like long COVID and other issues that can arise. Are you finding this same thing? I believe I heard on your podcast that about one in five parents are excited about getting the vaccine for their children.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, ultimately it comes down to, I guess, how much risk tolerance you want to have. I mean, I think every parent has to weigh this decision for themselves, but the reality is that this is still a serious disease, and it's, you know, every time your kid gets sick, it's not just the risk of hospitalization, it's missing school, it's missing work, missing activities with friends, So all of those things are, you know, things that you could potentially prevent with a vaccine. And so I think it's really important to remember that this isn't just about preventing deaths. It's about, you know, keeping people healthy and safe in their daily lives.
It seems to me now that I know more people who currently have COVID or have had it in the last month or two, myself included, you know, for the first time. And of course, we're getting a little sick. You know, for me, it was a really bad 36 hours and then I, you know, was fine. Fortunately, I was stuck in Mexico on the beach. So that extended my vacation, which was kind of nice. But you know, in terms of that fear that we had in the first year, you know, before the vaccine came out, we just don't have that fear anymore of COVID. Now we just figure it's something that we all have to go through. And I'm wondering if we're sort of losing sight of how, you know, how deadly this and contagious this disease can be. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm glad that you're doing well, that you're healthy again, and I'm sorry you had to go through that. But you're right, absolutely. People, I think more than half of the country has now had COVID. And, you know, for some people, it's very mild, but for others, it's incredibly serious. And I think the key difference is that now, you know, the majority of Americans have been vaccinated, and we shouldn't sort of minimize the fact that that probably helps a lot in terms of severity. So the people that are getting it now, I mean, a lot of times it's a breakthrough infection. And I think we have the vaccines to thank for the fact that this isn't more serious. But yeah, in terms of sort of how we think about this going forward, I think, you know, we have to keep in mind that there's still a risk of long COVID, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just wanted to clarify, everyone that I know, and including myself, that has had COVID recently are all fully vaccinated and boosted and all that. So that, again, you know, kind of lends the, you know, it adds to that feeling of it, COVID not being as serious.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Tanya Lewis. She's the senior editor of Health and Medicine at Scientific American, also a co-host of COVID Quickly podcast, which, by the way, we love. I mean, our show is long form, but I love the short form, you know, 7 or 8 minutes, boom. The topics are covered quickly and you basically find out what's going on in a short amount of time.
Yeah, well, thanks so much. I mean, that's the goal here. We're just trying to give you a quick update and kind of bring people up to speed.
Yeah. Let's talk about efficacy and efficacy percentages for these COVID vaccines comparing adults with kids.
Yeah, so, you know, what's different about the kids vaccine is that they used a slightly different benchmark when they were looking at efficacy. They really looked at the antibody response to the vaccine as opposed to just the, you know, protection against disease, because the number of cases of COVID in the study was so small that it gives you a much better kind of idea of how well the vaccines work to just look at the immune response. And they saw that both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines provided a very good immune response, similar to what was seen in older children and adults. But I have to caution that, you know, when you look at the raw sort of efficacy numbers and you see numbers like 80%, 50%, those are based on very small numbers of people. And the other thing to remember is that this vaccine is tested at a time when the Omicron variant was circulating, which is a very different variant than previous ones. So when we saw those 95% efficacy numbers with, you know, the first vaccines, you know, those were tested against a very different variant.
Yeah. So in your research and in your opinion, based on that research now, you know, what does this mean for summer plans, you know, being able to now vaccinate your child under 5? And what does it mean for the coming school year? Or does it really change much?
Yeah, so I definitely think it's a good thing. It's coming at a good time. Even if your child has had COVID, having the vaccine will give them, you know, additional protection. And we've seen from study after study that having just had an infection doesn't provide as good protection as having infection and vaccine. And it's important because there's going to be new variants, there's going to be different forms of it circulating in the fall and the winter, and you really want your child to have as much protection as possible.
Right. I wanted to ask you about herd immunity. Like, I don't even know if we're calling it that anymore, but certainly during the beginning of the pandemic, it was, you know, there was this whole field of belief that, oh, you need to expose people to it so we can get herd immunity. Now I think they're calling it something slightly different. And as I've said, with so many people now getting COVID, you know, how immune are we? How long do those, are they finding now that the antibodies are with you?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think that, you know, we've sort of moved away from talking about herd immunity as this concept where, you know, everyone's totally protected against getting infected. That's something that we have with, like, measles, for example, because the vaccines for measles are so good at preventing even infection that it really just doesn't circulate unless there's an outbreak. So I think what we're looking at now is more like partial immunity. And it's sort of like what we have with the flu. I mean, everybody's had the flu in some form at some point in their lives, and many of us have been vaccinated. So over time, you sort of build up this immune memory to the virus. And that means when you encounter a new version of it, your body's already somewhat prepared to fight it. But it doesn't mean that you can't ever get the disease again, unfortunately.
Tanya, what is the procedure for testing vaccines? And are there challenges finding patients that are sick when you're trying to put these studies together?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when you're testing a vaccine like this, it's always a challenge to try to get, you know, a big enough sample of people to test it in. And you always want to make sure that you're testing it in a group, you know, you have to have a control group. So you give one group of people the vaccine and you give another group a placebo so that you can really test if the vaccine is what's protecting those individuals, because otherwise you might just be seeing that one group of people was more careful than the other, for example. So that's part of it. In terms of infections, I think the second part of your question, you know, it is a challenge because this virus is circulating everywhere. So you want to make sure that the group that's vaccinated is actually, I mean, you don't want them to be exposed to the virus, but you have to have a certain number of infections in the study in order to see how well the vaccine works.
Is this a completely new vaccine that we're using for the kids, or is it a smaller dose of what we've been giving to seniors and regular adults?
So yeah, it's the same vaccine. It's just a smaller dose. So for example, the Pfizer vaccine consists, the vaccine for kids under five is 1/10 of the adult dose, and you get three doses of that. And the Moderna vaccine is about a quarter of the adult dose, and there are two doses.
I'm wondering about those, what we're calling a dose, because if it's, did you say three with Pfizer and how many with Moderna?
Yeah, so the Pfizer, each dose is 1/10 of the strength of an adult dose.
Okay.
So if you had, like, I guess 100 micrograms of the adult dose, then that would be 10 micrograms for the child's dose.
Okay. All right. And so
now you get three of those.
Okay. And now even among adults, are we calling it, we were calling it, you know, two doses of the vaccine, and then now you're able to get two boosters. I hear people saying, I've gotten four vaccines, and I say, well, wait, is that the boosters plus the vaccines? What is that? How are we referring to it now?
Yeah, so that's, I'm glad you brought that up because it depends on how you count it. So for the average person with no other sort of immune compromising conditions, you'll get two doses as the baseline series, and then you're now either eligible for one or two boosters, depending on how old you are. I think people over 50 can now get two boosters, and people under 50 can get one booster. Now, if you are immunocompromised or you're taking drugs that suppress your immune system, for example, those individuals need three doses for their primary series. So anything they get after that is a booster shot. So that's why you have some people with like four or five shots, but only one or two boosters.
Can you take us through the Can you take us through, first of all, the people with compromised immune systems are getting something that is a prophylactic or a preventative medication. Can you take us through those? And then also I wanted to launch into the talk about the antiviral drugs that you have talked about on COVID quickly.
Right. So with people who are immunocompromised, they are eligible for a drug called Evusheld, which is basically a form of monoclonal antibodies. And that's basically, you know, like when you have the vaccine, it trains your body to produce antibodies to the virus. But with this drug, you're essentially just giving people the antibodies. So this is really good for people that whose bodies are unable to sort of mount an immune response to the virus. So yeah, that's what some people are able to get.
Anya, this is for kids that are 6 months through 5 years. Is that correct?
Oh, no. Evusheld, I think, is only approved in adults, although I'm not, you know, don't quote me on that. But for children.
COVID vaccine.
Yeah, the vaccine we were talking about is for children under five.
Okay. And is it available right now?
It is. In fact, in most places, you can call your pediatrician or go to a local vaccine clinic and make an appointment to get the vaccine for your child.
Okay, great. Yeah, that'd be easier to go directly to the pediatrician where the child might have a relationship with the doctor and be comfortable rather than going to some tented area with people wearing goggles and things like that. It could scare the kids.
Yeah, no, I think that pediatricians are very experienced with giving vaccines. And so, you know, they have all the lollipops and everything.
Yeah. Tanya, what else you've been working on?
Well, so I've lately been covering the monkeypox outbreak that's been happening around the world. The monkeypox is another virus that it causes a characteristic pimple or blister like rash and flu like symptoms. And it's kind of a mystery because it was previously only endemic to a few countries in sub-Saharan Africa. But in the last, you know, year or so, we've been seeing cases in the UK, the US, Europe, and other countries. So that's one thing I've been covering. I've also been, of course, covering the landmark news about Roe versus Wade and sort of what that decision means for reproductive health and access to abortion for people throughout the country.
And can you give us the gist of that, what you've been talking about in Roe v.
Yeah.
Wade?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been, you know, extensive research on the impacts of abortion or on not being able to get an abortion. And what it basically shows is that, you know, it has very long-lasting impacts on the women or the pregnant person if they are unable to get an abortion. And in a bad way. So, for example, there was this big study called the Turnaway Study where they looked at women who were either given an abortion or they were turned away because they were just past the gestational cutoff in their state. And these women, you know, over time, they like measured their mental health, physical health, and financial health. And on all three measures, the women who were turned away from an abortion were worse off. So it just kind of underscores that abortion is healthcare. And I think when people think about whether, regardless of your sort of moral beliefs on it, you know, for individuals, this is an essential right that they should have. Just like any other form of healthcare, it should, you know, be between the doctor and the patient.
Yeah, that's an interesting commentary. I was going to ask you about, you know, writing about this in a science publication like Scientific American. It strikes me as interesting until you say that this is about healthcare. And of course, you as the senior editor of Health and Medicine at Scientific American, of course you would be talking about this. Have you found it difficult to write on?
Yeah, it's definitely touched a nerve, I would say. You know, I mean, I just want to say, you know, I kind of, for everyone out there, like, I know this is such a difficult issue. And I think, you know, one thing that I'm hoping to do is just to sort of shed some light on the sort of unintended consequences when people think about, you know, trying to save people's lives. You know, people when they're unable to access care like abortion, they will, you know, find other ways to do it. And unfortunately, that can be deadly itself. So I think, and another thing to mention is that it's not just about abortion. A lot of times, the skills that are needed for abortion training are also really critical for miscarriages, for example, and dealing with miscarriages. So if we don't allow people to get those skills, then other types of care can also suffer.
Right. I wanted to circle back with you on, well, monkeypox, but also the antiviral drugs. We were talking about that. And there was something in COVID quickly where you and Josh Fishman were talking about how the high vaccination rates, I think this is how it went. The high vaccination rates are making it now difficult to test antiviral drugs once you get COVID. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, you know, now we have effective antivirals like Pfizer's drug Paxlovid. It's actually much harder to find a group of people who are sick with COVID but are not actually getting that drug or don't want to get that drug. So you need to be able to test the effects of a new drug in a population that's not already receiving a different treatment. So it's paradoxical, but yeah, it's getting harder to test new drugs.
Well, and I would imagine that, you know, for example, how I felt when I got COVID, I would have participated in a test because I wasn't really fearful for, you know, how long I was going to be with it. Yes, I felt bad, but it wasn't horrible. I didn't feel like I was on my way to the hospital or anything like that. So is that maybe you need to find people that are not as sick, but yet then how difficult is it to test the efficacy of the antiviral drug if you're not that sick?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I think sometimes, you know, when they do these trials, they do look for sort of quote unquote healthy volunteers, people that, you know, don't have other risk factors. And that's a good place to start. But as you mentioned, you know, it's harder to test whether a drug prevents severe disease in vulnerable people without testing it in vulnerable people. So it's a tricky challenge. And we face this in other areas of medicine too. I mean, anytime there's an effective drug on the market, it's hard to sort of test new drugs because the old one, you don't want to withhold the already effective drug.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Tanya Lewis, Senior Editor of Health and Medicine at Scientific American and also co-host of COVID Quickly podcast. Tanya, we spoke a little bit about monkeypox, but what else is on the radar as far as viruses for the WHO and the CDC?
Well, you know, I mean, it's, you know, there's always the sort of older viruses that are already circulating. I mean, monkeypox has been around for decades. We've known about it for decades. It's not a new virus. You know, HIV is still circulating and it is still basically a pandemic as well. So, you know, there's many other viruses, Ebola, too many to list here really, but these are all things that are still causing huge burdens of disease around the world. You know, not so much Ebola right now, but, you know, it does cause periodic outbreaks. So these are things that the WHO and other agencies are always keeping a close eye on. And, you know, it just reinforces the fact that COVID is not the only disease out there. We still have a long way to go to eradicate other diseases like HIV and polio, for example.
Yeah, and Ebola was contained within three countries in Africa because it was killing the host before the virus had a chance to spread. Ebola is still out there. I thought that it had gotten knocked down completely, but it's
yeah,
still...
It still causes outbreaks periodically. So it's something that, you know, like it's definitely not as transmissible as COVID, fortunately, but, you know, with viruses, things evolve all the time. So it's maybe not the top of the list in terms of my worries right now, but I would say, you know, we got to keep an eye on stuff like monkeypox because we don't want another pandemic on our hands.
Right. Of course.
Tanya, I had just one question before we let you go in about a minute. And it has to do with a statistic I saw somewhere and I can't find it again, but you know, talking about the severity or the deadliness, the the fatalities among young children. There have been about 500 in children under five from COVID. And how does that compare to influenza? That you have that number in there somewhere, because I think people have this idea that COVID is just like the flu. You know, some people are going to die, but it's still much more deadly than influenza.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I don't have off the top of my head. I believe that influenza kills roughly about 80 or 90 kids a year. So, you know, it's not nothing, but it's not as much as COVID right now. So just to put things in perspective, you know, kids can die from viral illnesses. And so we shouldn't be complacent that just because most kids are fine, you know, for those individuals that do die, you know, even one death is too much.
Right.
Tanya Lewis is the senior editor of Health and Medicine at Scientific American. Tanya, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much. It's a great pleasure.
Great to have you, Tanya. Thank you.